Welcome to your weekly constitutional radio show where we talk about a subject that affects you every day, the United States Constitution. My name is Stuart Harris and I teach constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in beautiful Grundy, Virginia. And I'm speaking to you today from WETS HD1 and FM in Johnson City, Tennessee. We're going to talk today about an inconsistency. We're going to talk today about a disconnection between our national birth announcement and, well, our Constitution. When we were born, we noted in the Declaration of Independence that, in Jefferson's famous phrase, all men are created equal. But then 11 years later, when we adopted our Constitution, that word equality never made it into the Constitution. Instead, there was another word that was never mentioned. It was such a peculiar word, such a taboo subject, but the word was implied throughout our original Constitution, and that word, of course, is slavery. While our Constitution didn't explicitly approve of slavery, there were enough provisions in there accommodating slavery that it led some people, notably the Quakers, who were ardent abolitionists, to refuse to sign on to the Constitution. They called it a pact with the devil. And that basic contradiction between our highest ideals and our lowest impulses is perhaps the fundamental contradiction, the original sin in our constitutional history. Now, there'll be many shows in which we talk about slavery, we talk about its aftermath, we've already talked some about Jim Crow, but there's something impersonal about talking about it as an institution. So today, we're not going to talk about slavery, we're going to talk about one slave. His name was Paul Jennings, and he was extraordinary in a number of ways. He was personally extraordinary. His story will amply demonstrate that. He was extraordinary in the circumstances of his birth, because while he was born into a slaveholding house in 1799, the person who happened to own him was a fellow whose name you'll recognize. His name was James Madison. And James Madison not only had Paul Jennings among his slaves at Montpelier, but he took Paul Jennings with him to the White House. Hence the title of the book we're going to be discussing for today's episode. It's called A Slave in the White House, and the writer of that book is a very nice lady by the name of Elizabeth Dowling Taylor. She received her PhD from the University of California at Berkeley, and over her 22-year career in museum education and historical research, she was director of interpretation at Thomas Jefferson's Monticello, as well as director of education at James Madison's Montpelier. She was most recently a fellow of the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, and she's now an independent scholar and lecturer. Welcome to the show, Elizabeth Dowling Taylor. If I remember from your book, you say he was born around 1799, right?
Correct. He was born at Montpelier in 1799. He was the son of a Madison slave, herself the granddaughter of an Indian, and his father was an English merchant.
That's so interesting, and it's so such a common story. You have these white men typically fathering children with African-American slaves, and then the fathers just sort of disappear, and the offspring just are accepted into the slave community.
I was not able to learn more about Paul Jennings' father, so I do not know if he had a sustained relationship with Jennings' mother. It does not seem so.
Right. And there were about, if I recall, about 100 slaves at Montpelier at that time.
That's right.
And that's something, again, that's often overlooked. I know the people at Montpelier make no secret of it. In fact, they're very actively pursuing research in that area, as they are over at Monticello and at other places now. But it's not something that perhaps is commonly known, is that many of our founders had extensive slave holdings, and this was just one of those 100 that was born right around the turn of the 19th century.
Well, 8 of our early presidents owned slaves during their tenure as chief executive of this great republic.
Mm-hmm. Well, what happened with Paul then? So he spent his childhood at Montpelier?
Well, he spent his formative years at the White House.
Oh, okay.
He was only 10 when he was selected to be part of the domestic staff at the White House. Of course, the domestic side of things at that time was a private undertaking by the president's family.
Mm-hmm.
And James and Dolly Madison had a staff at the White House of about 10, a combination of free black and white workers, of slaves hired in the Capitol, and then maybe 3 or 4 slaves, including Paul Jennings, from their Virginia plantation.
And when you say hired, you mean hired from their owners?
That's right.
Right, so they were sort of rented slaves.
This was not uncommon in a city like Washington.
And in fact, that brings up another point. I'll just interject here that one of the reasons that the Southerners, at least, wanted the new federal city, Washington, D.C., to be located in the South was because they wanted to be able to take their slaves with them when they went to Congress or to some other government post.
Washington was very much a Southern city,
mm-hmm.
and signs of slavery were rampant, and especially foreign visitors remarked on this incongruity, that here the great republic that boasted endlessly of the rights of man were slave owners.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that. At some point, we'd have to talk about that. I like to tell my students that that is the great contradiction of our constitutional history, is that we're born with all of this soaring rhetoric about all men being equal. But the Constitution itself, of course, didn't say anything about equality, and in fact, just the opposite, until after the Civil War. And so Madison and Jefferson and the other slaveholding presidents were physical manifestations of that contradiction, and as was Paul Jennings.
Absolutely. Understanding slavery is central to understanding our American history. It's central to understanding James Madison or Thomas Jefferson. And yes, you'd say it's central as well to understanding Paul Jennings.
Indeed. Well, let's talk about him. So he arrives in, I guess, 1809, right?
That's right.
At the White House when Madison takes office. And what was his experience at the White House?
Well, he said that it was a dreary place initially. As well, it was. For one thing, Washington was a planned city, so it existed on paper to a much greater degree than it existed on the ground. Moreover, here's a boy of 10 away from home for the first time and undoubtedly homesick.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it didn't take too long for him to recognize that he was at the start of an adventure, and that he would see a lot, listen a lot, and be a witness to historical events. One thing about Paul Jennings is that he was an intelligent individual, and he was motivated to take advantage of certain circumstances. For example, he was literate. I learned from his great-granddaughter that the family tradition is that he learned to read and write in the presence of the little master, or the white boy, with the vision being that the white boy was the object of the instruction, while Paul Jennings was standing off to the side at attention, but was absorbing what was being talked about, and in that way learned to read and write. And I present that in A Slave in the White House as the first instance of his taking advantage of his circumstances.
Well, that's remarkable. That reminds me of that movie with Matt Damon a few years ago. I think it was called Good Will Hunting.
Uh-huh.
And you had this extraordinarily bright fellow working as a janitor, I think it was at MIT.
Yes, good point.
And well, I mean, the parallel just struck me a moment ago. And so in much the same fashion, this extremely bright slave boy takes advantage of the fact that he can pick up with a little bit of effort, maybe looking over the shoulder of the master boy, the white boy, can pick up how to read. And that was an extraordinary accomplishment for a slave.
It was. It's not easy to be just standing off to the side and be able to, in the end, become literate. And several of his letters are extant, written while he was a slave.
Wow. Okay. And so was he literate when he arrived at the White House, or was he still...
That we don't know. The letters that we have were written certainly while he was still a slave, but in the 1840s, so beyond his adolescence. But the impression that one gets, especially given the family history and young people's facility for picking up language, is that he did learn while still young.
Okay, so he shows up, maybe has some reading and writing already under his belt by the time he gets there. What was his experience at the White House? What sort of stuff was he assigned to do?
Well, he was a footman, And so that meant that he set and served meals, he assisted the coachman, he ran errands and messages. He pretty much did whatever the white steward told him to do. Now, later, when Madison retired, he would be promoted, if you will, to the position of Madison's personal manservant. In A Slave in the White House, I do develop the thesis that Jennings was able to absorb the theoretical underpinnings that allowed him to identify his innate yearning for freedom as a natural right of man.
Right. I mean, so he actually saw the contradiction firsthand. You know, you hear these guys sitting around talking about freedom and talking about
being... Well, he lived the contradiction.
Yeah, he lived it. I mean, and then he lived it. And then, of course, unlike most slaves, he got to actually get the theory as well.
Yes, you know, during Madison's 19-year retirement, his main endeavor was to review and organize the papers of his life's work, articulating and defending individual rights and self-government. And he was visited by all kinds of notables, from Thomas Jefferson to Andrew Jackson to Daniel Webster, but also by young men of learning. And they would tend afterwards to write up this remarkable experience of how they spent an evening at the feet of the master, the premier political philosopher of the day, as he expounded on the Constitution and so forth. Well, here's Paul Jennings, like part of the wallpaper in Madison's study. Mm-hmm. Just imagine how many hundreds of such conversations he listened in on.
Is there ever any evidence or any account that he had a substantive conversation with Madison? Was there ever a moment when he said, hey, Mr. Madison, what about this freedom stuff and what about me?
Well, we do have certain kinds of evidence. For example, a University of Virginia professor who was visiting with Madison in his study later remarked on the remarkable relationship between Madison and his manservant and said that the slave expressed himself as if talking with a brother and that he did this in a way that was inoffensive, which is quite remarkable in and of itself, and I think shows that Jennings had really honed his skills to be able to have this relaxed and comfortable relationship with Madison, not only when they were alone, but even in a way that would strike this peer of Madison's as impressive but not offensive. On the other hand, I think they had a strong bond. I think they had a mutual respect, but I do not think that Madison and Jennings ever altogether bridged the very deep divide between black slave and white elite.
Right. Yeah, that's a pretty big chasm to cross.
Way deep.
Yeah, way deep. Now, before we leave the White House years, though, I believe that Paul Jennings was, in fact, credited as being the fellow who actually followed Dolly Madison's direction to remove the famous painting of George Washington as the British advance during the War of 1812. Is he, in fact, the fellow who did that?
Yes, he and a couple of other servants. Now, you know, this is a great American legend, and there are numerous myths associated with it. But what we can say is on the day that Washington was destined to be attacked and burned by the British in the course of the War of 1812, Madison was at the front, literally, commander-in-chief at the front being less than 10 miles away from the nation's capital. And when it became clear that the Americans could not hold off the British, word was sent to Dolly Madison at the White House to evacuate, which she did. She gathered up some White House treasures, but before she jumped into her carriage, she turned to Jennings and the other servants and said, "Save that portrait of George Washington." She understood its symbolic value and did not want the British to have the opportunity to defile it. So Paul and two others, with great difficulty, because this thing is enormous, 95 inches high, way bigger than the 6'3" George Washington. But finally, they managed to break the frame and release the portrait as a stretched canvas. It was carried away to safety in that condition, and then eventually returned to the White House, where, of course, it hangs to this day.
Well, we quite appropriately give Dolly Madison credit for thinking of that, but the actual heavy lifting, as was so often the case in those days, was done by slaves, and specifically including Paul Jennings. So he does have a prominent role, albeit a very small one, in standard American history text.
There you go.
Remarkable. Okay, well, so he had his experience at the White House. He helped to save the famous portrait of George Washington. The White House years ended after 8 years. He returned to Montpelier with Madison. They had their close relationship. What else can you tell us about Paul Jennings?
Well, for one thing, let me say that Jennings hesitated about going back to Virginia. Hmm. There is evidence that he and two other of the home slaves had contemplated running away. Mm-hmm. They were going to join up with sea vessels in need of cooks. Now, we know this because they were informed on by a nephew of James Madison. This would be just 2 months before the Madison administration ended. And this nephew wrote to Madison and alerted him to this circumstance, this rumor. And we can imagine Paul thinking about this, his last window of opportunity to act before the Madison household would go back to Virginia for good. Mm-hmm. And in A Slave in the White House, I make the point that thinking about this wasn't just a matter of, gee, will I get away with this? One has to remember that Montpelier was Paul Jennings' home, too. It was the scene of his boyhood, the home of his mother, who he was always very close to. And one does not easily leave one's home forever. It's not as if he could have said, well, I'll be back at Christmas.
Right. It was such a difficult choice. And as you point out in your book, he took the choice of accommodation and accommodating himself to this terrible reality of being enslaved and simply did the best he could within the institution.
Yes, that's right. I do like to stress that all people, no matter what their circumstances, try to instill meaning and gratification into their lives. And contrary from the impression that one would glean from history books not all that long ago, slaves were no exception. They had active spheres of action and imagination, just like everybody else.
Sure. There's a great mythology that's grown up maybe an apology for slavery in this country that up until quite recently even manifested itself at wonderful places like Monticello or Montpelier. And I happen to know this. I'll just tell a brief story myself. I was visiting Monticello with an exchange student that stayed with us for a year. Her name was Tembi Sibanda from Zimbabwe. And she was African, obviously, and we took her to Monticello on a tour. And the questions of slavery came up occasionally, and it came up during our tour. And immediately, as soon as she asked a question about slavery, another visitor to Monticello piped in, oh, well, Thomas Jefferson was a good master. And there's always that suggestion, oh, well, you know, slavery wasn't that bad. The slaves were happy, etc. Well, no. There was always a yearning for freedom, and there was always a knowledge among the slaves that they were enslaved, and so that's a myth. I mean, these slaves knew they were slaves, and they didn't want to be slaves.
Well, you know, this still goes on with all my experience at Monticello and Montpelier, that the most common kind of excuse, if you will, that you'll hear from visitors is that very one. But he was good to his slaves, wasn't he? They want the guide to make it all right. I remember one visitor who asked specifically, where do I go for the great man tour? Well, there isn't the great man tour and the slave owner tour, or there shouldn't be. This is all one man.
Exactly, and the contradictions are what make them human. That is, in fact, as we said before, it's a very contradiction of our Constitution. It's a very contradiction of our nation. And we can't shy away from it. And I want to give credit where credit is due. Places like Montpelier, places like Monticello, are looking very squarely at the slavery issue now, and they have been for some years, and they're very, very open about it. And if you go there today, if you go to Montpelier, certainly, they're not going to hide it.
No. As director of interpretation at Monticello for over 10 years and then director of education at Montpelier for a decade, I saw an opportunity to make a small contribution to these historic houses and plantations owned by presidents to tell a fuller story of our African-American heritage. It's very vital that this kind of interpretation just starts with simple acknowledgement. Yes, these men were slave owners. No, they did not free their slaves in their will, and so on. We do tend to make excuses for our founding fathers who were slave owners. They were men of their time. They had to put union first. They didn't understand that we're all one biological race, and so on. But there is no doubt that Thomas Jefferson and James Madison both understood that slavery was that it was immoral, that it was an evil of great magnitude. Jefferson called it an abominable crime.
And yet
he allowed that should a violent contest between slaves and slave owners ever transpire, there was no doubt which side God would be on.
Yep, and we have to remember that as we look at these great marble statues, that these men were not made of marble. They were made of flesh and blood, both the slave owners and the slaves, and they were all imperfect, and these contradictions did exist. It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm talking today to Elizabeth Dowling Taylor, who's written a remarkable book called A Slave in the White House. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and we'll talk some more to Elizabeth Dowling Taylor.
The ink is black, the page is white. Together we learn to read and write. A child is black, a child is white.
Once again, Kelly Carmichael from the Center for the Constitution at James Madison's Montpelier strides into our consciousness, if not our studio, armed with a difficult and fascinating constitutional quiz question. Kelly, are you with us?
I am here. Hello. I am ready to challenge our new victim today.
Okay. Victim, contestant, would you introduce yourself for our audience, please?
I am Casey Johnstone from Rochester, New York.
Rochester, New York. You know, I'm originally from Rochester, Michigan, and there is a historical connection between the two. I think people migrated down the St. Lawrence Seaway from New York to Michigan, and they started naming towns in southeastern Michigan after towns in upstate New York. We have a Utica, Michigan, right down the road from us. See? So there's a relationship here. And you didn't even realize it, did you?
No.
You're bored already, aren't you? All right, Kelly, let's get to the quiz.
All right, here is your question. We're talking about the idea of freedom of expression, which exemplifies a constitutionally protected freedom of expression. A, knowingly publishing lies in a newspaper. B, burning a United States flag in protest. C, speech causing imminent lawless action, or D, falsely yelling fire in a crowded theater.
So which of those is actually protected by the Constitution? Is that the question?
That is the question. Which one is protected of all of these various acts?
All right, I'm looking at you.
Can you repeat the answers, please?
Sure. The answer choice number one, A, knowingly publishing lies in a newspaper.
Is that protected by the Constitution?
No.
It's not. Why not? Why wouldn't it? I mean, I don't know. I see things in the newspaper that I think maybe aren't truthful all the time. But you're certain that's not protected?
Yes.
Okay. What's the next one, Kelly?
B, burning a United States flag in protest.
That's not protected.
That's not protected?
No.
Oh, the United States flag. It's a pretty important symbol. Okay. What about the next answer choice?
C, speech causing imminent lawless action.
Okay, so if one person says something and that's going to cause somebody else to commit a crime, is that protected?
No.
That's not protected either? Okay, well, we're running out of answer choices here. What's the last answer choice, Kelly?
The last choice, falsely yelling fire in a crowded theater when there is no fire.
I don't think that could
you've got to pick one of them. You've got to pick one of them. So so far, our first pass through, you say none of them's protected by the Constitution.
This takes me back to all those multiple choice tests I used to have to take, and when you didn't know the answer was always C.
Is that what it is? Just pick C? Is that what you're going to do?
I'm not saying it's C, but...
I'm going to guess C.
Do you even remember what C is?
Not really.
We've got a guesser here today, Kelly. She's going to guess C, which is speech causing imminent lawless action. What is
unfortunately, the theory of picking C when you don't know the answer didn't work out quite so well for you this time. Actually, the correct answer is B. Burning a United States flag in protest is an example of something that's protected under the freedom of expression. We may not agree with it, but it is constitutionally protected.
I can tell from the look of shock on your face that really shocks you, that the burning a flag is protected speech.
It does.
Yeah. That's a very, very controversial opinion. I think it was about 20 years ago that the U.S. Supreme Court actually considered the criminal conviction in Texas of a young man who had not only taken down a flag and not only burned it, but had then chanted, I think, a red, white, and blue, we spit on you, or something similarly offensive. He was convicted in Texas under a criminal statute, but then the court said, you know, as much as it pains us to say this, that's what the First Amendment protects, even really vile, objectionable speech like this. And it was a tough decision for everybody involved. I think especially Justice Scalia, who's, you know, a fairly conservative, patriotic fellow most of the time. I'm sure they're all patriotic, but I mean, he's of a more conservative ilk. But he joined in the opinion, and I think it really pained him. In fact, the story goes that the next day he came downstairs for breakfast, and his wife was humming, "You're a grand old flag." She was not at all happy with his decision to go along with that opinion. But that is the law, and I'm sorry.
So that sounds like treason.
I think there'd be a lot of people who would agree with you on that one, too.
A lot of people are upset by that opinion, even to this day. But thank you very much for playing, and we appreciate you at least giving it the old college try.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kelly.
Thank you.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional, and we're talking to Elizabeth Dowling Taylor about her new book about James Madison's slave, Paul Jennings.
And let me bring up another name, and that would be Edward Coles. He was one of these young men of learning, a member of the rising generation who Jefferson predicted would not tolerate slavery because they would have taken in liberty, ideals of liberty, with their mother's milk. And such was the case with this Edward Coles, who was from the same Piedmont, Virginia area as Jefferson and Madison. And he realized that slavery and republicanism were incompatible. And he was a devotee of Jefferson and Madison and their natural rights theory, and he wanted to see them make a stand for slavery at the period that they were both retired but prestigious former presidents, a time at which they seemed to think, as historian Joe Ellis put it, that silence on the issue of slavery was the highest form of leadership. Now, Coles thought that he had talked his mentor, James Madison, into freeing his slaves in his will.
Oh, really?
Yes, he was very concerned with Madison's legacy. And he was devastated when Madison died, and no, instead he had bequeathed his slaves to his widow. Coles wrote, "This is most unfortunate for Mr. Madison's memory and for the peace and happiness of his widow. He has now died without freeing one slave, no, not even Paul." So and there is other evidence, too, that Paul in particular had reason to expect that he would be freed by the terms of Madison's will. The evidence suggests that in the end, Madison had an understanding with Dolly that she would free the slaves at her death. Well, not only did that not happen, but Dolly Madison started selling slaves almost immediately that her husband died. Now, she did have a 1841 will, this be 5 years after Madison died, and there was a term there that would free Paul Jennings, the only slave so treated. But in the end, that was not to be.
How come?
Well, Dolly Madison sold Montpelier, and she moved back to Washington. They had a house a block away from the White House on Lafayette Square. And Paul Jennings was an important part of Dolly's household staff. Well, Paul Jennings had married a woman back in Virginia who was owned by a different master. Of course, slave marriages were not recognized by law. And Paul's children, as they came along, belonged to the owner who held his wife. When Dolly sold Montpelier and Paul had to go with her to Washington, that separated him from his family in Virginia altogether. And the same year that Dolly sold Montpelier, his wife died. So now his children back in Virginia are motherless, and Paul struggled to keep up with them.
Okay, so what happened after that?
Well, at one point, Jennings got on Dolly's bad side. She had, and at this time, by the way, she had actually been hiring him out to President James Polk at the White House. So Jennings had a second White House experience starting in 1845. But during that summer, she allowed him to go back to Orange to visit with his children and with his mother. But she stayed longer than she had anticipated. And that's when she wrote a letter to her son saying that Paul will lose the best place and the convenient resources of his mistress. And that was when she wrote up a document that would free him to the first one to offer $200. Now, this is a low price for a skilled houseman like Paul Jennings. And I believe that that was Dolly's gesture to him to set a low price, hoping that he could generate that money himself. Well, $200 is way more than Paul Jennings could come up with. And that is when he went to Senator Daniel Webster for help.
Senator Daniel Webster, another giant of early American constitutional history, of course, in the 19th century, one of the great triumvirate of senators at that time. Well, he and Clay and Calhoun, but that's a whole other story. But how does Daniel Webster figure into this? What did he do when he was approached by Paul Jennings?
Well, you know, we talked earlier about Paul Jennings being a good listener. Paul Jennings was also a good networker, to use a modern parlance. He was a slave, but he knew people in high places, and he used those contacts appropriately. You know, Webster not only visited at Montpelier, but he had a house on Lafayette Square a block away from Dolly Madison's. So Paul would have been well known to him. And one thing that I put together in my book, A Slave in the White House, is a history of Daniel Webster that is not well known. And that is that he had a pattern of purchasing to free slaves in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
He would never own a slave, but he did in any number of cases do what he would do for Paul, purchase a slave and then immediately free them. But he was not a rich man, and they would work in Webster's employ to pay back the sum. So really what it came down to was an advance. Paul Jennings always maintained that he bought his freedom of Dolly Madison, and so he did, but it was Webster who advanced his purchase price, if you will.
Okay, so then he's free. Paul Jennings is free. What does he do next?
Well, I'll tell you two things that he does next. First of all, he marches himself down to the photography studio, and he sits for his daguerreotype.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is the only known image of any Montpelier slave, and I discovered it at the home of Paul Jennings' great-granddaughter. I had the distinct honor of getting to know Sylvia Jennings Alexander starting in June of 2008. She was 93 years old, the keeper of the Jennings family oral traditions. She had at that point, as you might imagine, physical maladies, but she was sharp as a tack mentally, totally into family history. And on the wall of her living room is this wonderful image of her great-grandfather.
You discovered this?
Yes, and it's on the cover of A Slave in
America. Yeah, I saw it on the cover of your book. Well, I know that scholars love to discover documents or other evidence that, at the very least, is not widely known. That must have been quite an aha moment for you.
Oh, believe me. You know, I had thought if ever I could find a photograph of Paul Jennings, that'd be great. I'd be lucky to see one of him as an old man. I'd look into the face but not really be able to sense the vital man. But here he was in his prime, and he has this formidable Frederick Douglass-like fierceness about him. He has very cool, light-colored eyes. And he shows all of his genetic makeup at once, his Afro, Anglo, and African-American genetic background.
Now, how old
was
he?
He's holding a book, so this has to be his prop of choice. He's proud of his literacy.
He must have been. Well, how old was he when the picture was made?
He would be in his late 40s. And that's why I say I think because of dating this daguerreotype that it has to be one of the first things he did as a free man.
Mm-hmm.
And now one of the other first things he did in his first full year of freedom, 1848, he risked that hard-won status by helping others attempt to reach freedom in what turned out to be the largest scale ever attempted slave escape in American history.
Oh, you got to tell me more about that.
This was part of the Underground Railroad, the so-called Pearl episode. In the black of night on April 15th, 1848, 77 enslaved men, women, and children of Washington, including a runaway slave of Dolly Madison's, stowed themselves below deck on a schooner named Pearl. They hoped to make it to freedom in the north. Well, the schooner left the harbor but met up with light winds on the Potomac. That slowed them down. When they finally got to the Chesapeake Bay, the winds were too rough to enter. So they still might have made it to freedom in the north, but for an informant back in Washington, who alerted the owner sooner instead of later, and a posse caught up with the Pearl, hauled the schooner back to Washington, and most of those slaves on board faced the fate they most dreaded, which was sail to the Deep South and permanent separation from home and family.
Oh, that's very sad. Paul Jennings was part of that attempt, was he?
He was one of the black operatives in Washington working with white northern abolitionists to plan this out.
Mm. Did he get caught? I mean, was he punished for this?
No. It was a well-conceived plan with intelligence dispensed on a need-to-know basis. So the three-member crew were the only whites involved or conspirators involved who were apprehended by the authority. And only one among them really knew a lot about the plan and the others involved, and he refused to give up any other names.
Okay. Well, that was a narrow escape for Paul. I'm sorry the others didn't make it, but so he was actively, I mean, he becomes free, and he immediately turns around and uses his freedom to try to help other people. That was quite a statement.
Yes, I think so.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking to Elizabeth Dowling Taylor, the author of a book called A Slave in the White House. It's the story of Paul Jennings, and the theme is that Paul Jennings, a slave, was nonetheless able to rise in American society.
Well, we're moving on.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional, and let's talk some more with Elizabeth Dowling Taylor, author of A Slave in the White House. What next? What happens next? He's getting close to 50 now. What does he do next?
Well, let me tell you another story of Paul Jennings as ACE networker.
Mm-hmm.
He obtains a letter of recommendation from Daniel Webster. You know, the usual faithful, sober, and so on. And Webster hands it to him with Paul Jennings written on the envelope. I found this original letter of recommendation in that envelope in the papers of Alfred Chapman. So who is Alfred Chapman?
Yeah, that was going to be my next question.
Well, he's a cousin of James Madison,
mm-hmm,
from Orange County, but he is living and working in Washington at this time. He's a clerk in the Department of the Interior. Next thing you know, Paul Jennings gets a job in the Department of the Interior. So what I visualize is Paul Jennings going over there to the government agency with this letter of recommendation in his hand and passing it on to Alfred Chapman. You know me. I'm from Orange. Any chance you could use your connections here to get me a job in the Department of the Interior? This kind of patronage, of course, made all the difference. And as I say, these are low-level jobs for black men, but they're coveted. They're about the highest a black man could be expected to climb at this time in antebellum Washington.
Yeah, quite significant. In fact, Paul Jennings was quite an operator.
Yes.
I mean, again, he was born in horrible circumstances, but he made the very best he could of them, and he continued to do so after he'd purchased his freedom. So then what exactly did he do at the Department of Interior?
Well, his designation was laborer, and it's interesting to note that when black men worked in any of the government agencies, no matter what they actually did, and in some cases they indeed were copyists and clerks, they still had to make do with the designation laborer, or maybe messenger or doorkeeper. Now, the vice versa was true as well, in the sense that Alfred Chapman, for example, he had the title of clerk, but he grasped that all he was assigned to do was to open up the mail. So we don't really know exactly what Jennings' duties were, though his job title, as I say, was laborer. Now he has a good, steady job working in a government agency. He's in the pension office, which is under the Department of the Interior. And he has married again, so he has a second wife. But his children are still enslaved back in Virginia. So that's one of his next big goals.
Well, was he able to achieve that goal?
Well, you know, he was fortunate, if you will, in terms of his own children being released from slavery. And that is because their owner was a Quaker from Philadelphia.
Wait a minute. Now, Quakers were notable for their abolitionist sentiment. So you had a Quaker in Virginia who was also a slave owner.
Yes, and that's because, I mean, he had come, his father before him, this fellow's name is Charles Howard, and his father before him had acquired interests in Virginia, and Charles Howard himself moved there and married a Virginian. So her father was the slave owner, and when he died, he bequeathed his slaves to his sons and sons-in-law, and that's how Charles Howard became a slave owner. He, at that time, acquired the young girl who was to be Paul Jennings' wife, and then they had children together. She died in 1844. Now, Charles Howard, over his lifetime, freed 22 slaves. I don't think he was ever comfortable being a slave owner. Two of those slaves he freed in his lifetime were Paul's two youngest children, and then the other two surviving children were freed in 1856 by the terms of Howard's will. He was lucky that Howard was apparently anti-slavery, and that he had no children of his own who might have not appreciated this move.
Yeah, you know, in fact, that's a very interesting contrast. You have this fellow who's brought up elsewhere, presumably, I'm guessing, Pennsylvania, since he was a Quaker.
That's right.
And then, abolitionist sentiments. The Quakers were there were many Quakers who excoriated the Constitution when it was ratified as being a pact with the devil because of all of its pro-slavery parts. So then he, through this circumstance of his father's and his own investments in Virginia, he finds himself in Virginia and inheriting slaves.
Yeah.
What do you do? I mean, you know.
Fell in love with a Virginian.
Yeah. I mean, what do you do? You're in Virginia society. It sounds like he really had a struggle and he had to figure out how to do the right thing. And it sounds like he ultimately did. But it was probably, there was a lot more complexity to it than would meet the eye, I'd bet.
Yeah, so these four children went back to Washington then with their father, and it was at this same time, we're in the 1850s now, that Paul was able to buy a modest wood frame house on L Street in Northwest Washington. Today, this is a fully commercial corridor, but at the time that Paul bought this house for $1,000, it was a place where rabbits could be shot and huckleberries grew in season.
Right. L Street, what was the cross street?
18th. L and 18th.
Yeah, that definitely is not a place to hunt rabbits now.
Most recently, that was a Borders Books.
Okay.
And I went there and had a cup of coffee in their cafe and thought to myself, I could be sitting at Paul Jennings' kitchen table.
Yes, you might have been, but for a little bit of temporal displacement.
Yeah.
All right, so he's finally, the Jennings family is all together. Paul with his second wife and his children from his first wife. Did they have any additional children, Paul and his second
wife? No, Paul and his second wife did not have children together. She, at this point, when they married, was a single parent, just as Jennings was. And then she died, so he was widowed twice.
Huh.
He married a third time. You know, his great-granddaughter said that her grandfather, who was Paul's son, Franklin, said that Paul Jennings described his father as a Jim Dandy.
You mean a ladies' man?
Yeah, well, a bit of a ladies' man, you know, somebody who was a hot stuff.
Uh-huh.
Paul's son said that if he had any extra money, he made sure that he had fine kidskin shoes.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that, I mean, he had a very serious side, too. He played the violin. He liked to read. He was precise in his way. But I think of him as a man about town in Washington, and I think about all the Washington history that he experienced from the time he first went to Washington in 1809 until he died there in 1874 at the age of 75.
You know, that's really true, and it's kind of funny to think about it this way. I mean, he's a man who's born into the lowest rung of society as a slave, and yet his immediate surroundings are the very highest.
Yes.
The very highest. I mean, he's at Montpelier in the mansion of a Virginia planter. He's at the White House itself. He's in Washington society, if not of it. He's in it. He's immersed in it. So he picks up things like the violin. He reads. He writes. He has expensive tastes when it comes to clothes and when he's in a position to buy them himself. So he was really a sophisticate who got his sophistication in a rather unusual way.
Jennings' life was a deliberate and courageous and successful pursuit of that most American of promises, the right to rise.
Yep. Yeah, and he was rising. Okay, and he was witnessing all this history. And was there anything else significant he did?
Well, I think it's very significant that all three of his sons were active in the Civil War. When black men were allowed, starting in 1863, many of them wanted the opportunity not only to free the slaves, but to prove their manhood and their fitness for citizenship, to impact how their race would be treated after the war.
Mm-hmm. And so they enlisted in the Union Army?
Yes. Paul Jennings' son Franklin, for example, was in the 5th Massachusetts Colored Cavalry.
Oh, that's the famous one from the film.
No, that's not the one from the film.
I'm sorry.
The 5th Massachusetts Colored Cavalry.
Oh, cavalry, okay.
Yeah.
I didn't, you just taught me something. I did not realize that there were any African Americans that were in cavalry units.
Yes, there were, although for a period this regiment was denied their sabers and mounts. But then later they were returned to them, and this particular unit or regiment that Franklin Jennings was part of had the distinct pleasure of entering Richmond mounted four abreast on the heels of the retreating Confederate Army in early April of 1865.
That must have been quite a moment for them.
No small pleasure.
No small pleasure, I'm sure. All right, so the Jennings sons are doing very well, and apparently the Jennings clan has continued to thrive through the years because you've met many of them, haven't you?
Yes, and they are, for the most part, well-to-do African-Americans who, like their ancestor, value education, achievement, and activism.
Are they still mostly located around Washington, D.C., or have they dispersed?
There are a good number in the greater Washington metropolitan area, but there are others in Texas and California and New York, all four corners of the country.
Like most other Americans.
Well,
yeah. Anything else you want to share with us about Paul Jennings or about the Jennings family? There was one great story you told about them coming together in, I think, 2009.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. I had opportunity as director of education at Montpelier to involve them there. For example, on Constitution Day, which, as you know, is the 17th of September, and on that day in 2008, there was a large commemoration. Oh, we had 5,000 people that day at Montpelier. And a direct descendant of Paul Jennings and a collateral descendant of James Madison, he has no direct descendants, together read the preamble to the Constitution. And
wow.
Most people there that day agreed that this was the most affecting part of the Constitution Day commemoration.
Oh, that is.
And then it was only a few months after that I organized a reunion at Montpelier of all the Jennings descendants. Present were direct descendants of the three Jennings children who outlived him, with new cousins meeting one another for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
Sylvia Jennings Alexander, the keeper of the Jennings oral traditions was present, but she was not present the next time the Jennings descendants got together for a reunion, and that one was at the White House.
Well, tell us about that one.
Well, it occurred on the anniversary of the day their ancestor helped save that iconic portrait of George Washington, namely the 24th of August. So this is in 2009. And the Jennings descendants were treated to a private tour of the White House and an official portrait gathered together under this George Washington likeness that might not grace the East Room of the White House today were it not for the actions of their ancestors and their ancestor as well as Dolly Madison and others.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Sylvia Jennings Alexander was too ill at that point to attend the White House event, and she died a few months after that. And as far as it's known, the Jennings surname went with her. So I'm very grateful that I had the opportunity to get to know her over the last year and a half of her life.
Oh, I'm sure you are. And in fact, I note one other thing. You mentioned the date of that reunion in front of the Gilbert Stuart portrait of Washington. And that, of course, was in 2009. And you can't ignore the fact that at that time, our first African-American president was in the White House.
Oh, I mean, it's just extraordinary. You know, it was in 1809 that James Madison, the fourth president, took the oath of office to protect and defend the Constitution that he helped found. And it was 200 years later that the 44th president, Barack Obama, took the same oath. And yes, the first African-American president. We progressed from a enslaved liveried footman like Paul Jennings being the only allowable role for a black man in the White House to the first African-American chief executive in his family making their home in that historic structure. So it was a great feeling.
Quite a turnabout, quite a turn of history.
I mean, it's a shame, shame on us that it took 200 years, but...
Well, let's hope the next 200 are a little bit better.
Let's hope that we take a sprint to the finish line in becoming altogether post-racial.
Let us hope so. Well, Elizabeth Dowling Taylor, I have so enjoyed speaking with you today about your wonderful book, A Slave in the White House, and I really appreciate your time.
Well, I have really enjoyed talking with you as well. Thank you so much for having me.
Wasn't that a great interview with Elizabeth Dowling Taylor, the author of this remarkable new book, A Slave in the White House, the story of Paul Jennings and his rise from slavery into American society. We're also on the internet. We're all over it. So if you'd like to hear this episode again, or if maybe you only heard a little bit of it on the radio, go ahead and Google us. Google your weekly constitutional. You'll come up with our Facebook page. You'll come up with our iTunes link. You'll come up with WETS.org. There's just so many ways to listen. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, it's your constitution, and you need to learn about it.